All right, Shalom Aleichem, everyone. For those who don't know me, I'm Rabbi Stephen Gottlieb, currently the interim rabbi at Young Israel of Ottawa, as well as one of the outreach rabbis for JET, Jewish Education Through Torah, right here in Ottawa. And I'm here with my friend and colleague, Rabbi Moshe Kurtz. Rabbi Kurtz is currently the assistant rabbi at Congregation Agudath Shalom in Stamford, Connecticut. And he's written numerous articles and various publications in the Jewish world on issues of interest to the American community. Most recently, he published a new book, Challenging Assumptions, which is exploring different issues that are of particular relevance in the synagogue and beyond. So, Moshe, it's wonderful to have you in this Zoom room. I'm wondering if you could just first share a little bit on, why write this book? What is it offering, and how is the process going?
Okay, thanks so much for having me, Reb Steve Shlita. It's great to be with you. It's okay, we're first name basis. I picked up those Reb Ezra Schwartzisms. So anyway, I know, Steve, you just gave all that praise that I wrote all these articles, but as you'll see when you get your own copy in the acknowledgments, I do give you a shout out to thank you because behind the scenes in making these articles, which became chapters, which became the book, Reb Steve, you contributed a lot to our Milchamta Shel Torah, our discussions back and forth that became the final product. You didn't see eye to eye with me on every single thing, which is important. That's how it's
I'd be
supposed to work.
disappointed if we did.
Right. It would be very boring otherwise. Ayin, Rav Yochanan, Reish Lakish, and all of that. So you asked me why I wrote the book, right? So I have to preface with it's the story I heard attributed to Rav Moshe Feinstein, but insert your favorite gadol here. That someone came to Moshe Feinstein and asked him for an approbation for Haskama on his own sefer. And while Rav Moshe was giving him an informal faher on the spot, asking questions about what he wrote in the content of the book, the author eventually said, Rebbe, I have to admit, I know I wanted to share Torah, but like there's also like I feel like there's an element of gaiva, like almost like this arrogance or this pride that I have that I'm producing this book. Like it's about me. Ramosha said to him that, you're better than most people because at least you acknowledge that that's the truth. And what I try to take away from that story is understanding that everyone who puts out a book, virtually everyone, I should say, is motivated by an element of gaiva. And the only difference is there are those who acknowledge it and those who don't. And I attempt to be part of that group that acknowledges that there's an element of gaiva in there. So that's number one. Putting that aside, or keep that in mind. There, I like to think that there's also some loftier intentions behind putting out a sefer other than just trying to raise my own profile. One of them is just a little bit of my own writing history. When I was first, I think already in Smicha, a lot of my writings were a little bit more op-ed-ish. I like put an op-ed in the Foer or Times of Israel article. At a certain point, especially after some musser from my wife Marissa as well, I thought to myself, like, what am I doing? I'm in rabbinical school. I'm learning rabbinic texts all day. I'm being trained in halacha. Why am I writing a bunch of opinion articles where you give a bichsvar? I just throw out my own opinion. Why don't I actually see what the Torah has to say about all these matters and root my ideas in the Torah? Now, with the challenge, of course, of not coming in with a preconceived notion and validating it with whatever I find in the Torah, that's a challenge. Everyone comes in with their own bias, myself included. But really, these discussions about the really important issues that I try to discuss in the book, whether it be political correctness, whether it be gender, whether it be nationalism, the idea is it shouldn't just be Moshe Kurtz on the fly on his armchair giving his own ideas, but we should see what Gedolim v'Tovim mimeni, those who are greater than me, what Chazal, what Rishon, what Achronim, and ultimately to figure out what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want. That's ultimately the goal. So the title Challenging Assumptions, which my publishers at Mosaica Press helped me figure out, I think really is the underlying theme of the book. As you will talk about, a number of the chapters, there are a lot of scattered, almost in unconnected topics in there. But what is the underlying theme is that each and every chapter is trying to challenge a preconceived assumption that many hold dear. Now, the audience that I'm trying to challenge may vary from chapter to chapter. For instance, when I talk about whether it's permissible to dance on Shabbos and Yontif, when I talk about whether one should make a siyum during the 9 days, I am challenging an assumption that's widely held in the frum religious Orthodox community. But when I talk about, let's say, political correctness or assumptions of gender norms, I think there it's a little more obvious that I'm challenging an assumption that's held a little bit more widely in more Western, more secularized communities. When I talk about flags in shul, whether an American flag or certainly an Israeli flag, I'm in the monorthodox community. I'm in a very Zionistic community. That's wonderful. But we have to ask ourselves, why do we celebrate the state of Israel? What is our relationship to Zionism? What is our relationship to nationalism? What is our relationship to God when we're doing that? So that motivated the chapter on flags in shul, whether they belong there. And then finally, I'll just end one final thing. Final audience whose assumptions I was trying to challenge was my own. That particularly motivated the chapter on whether to bring children into shul and how to do it right. I thank God, and my daughter just went back to daycare after the summer for the first time. And as we speak, I hope she's transitioning really well to her new class after spending the whole summer with us. But for almost the first year of her life, every day during the weekday, I'd have to bring her to Shacharis because my wife would have to commute really far very early in the morning to get to her work. So the people in my community were very nice. They were very welcoming to her. But Lemaisa, there is a psikresha. There's going to be a certain disturbance by virtue of having a child in shul. And even if they don't make noise, there's people like, ooh, she's so cute, you know. So I don't know. Maybe I'm distracting them from having kavana during davening instead of thinking about God. They're thinking about that adorable little girl over there. So that motivated my chapter on bringing children into shul. The general idea behind it, as I put it right at the beginning of the introduction, is that ultimately that our thoughts are not necessarily what God is thinking, and we should try to align ourselves with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately wants from us in all these different challenging situations.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm reminded at a few different points, actually, of a conversation that we both had with our shared teacher, Mori Harabi, Rabbi J.J. Schachter.
I was going to say that for the end, but go for it.
No. But
please.
So firstly, just accepting Musa from our wives, very, very important. But what I was particularly remembering was conversation we both had with him about how every concession we have, it shouldn't just be hawk. It shouldn't just be, you know, talking about the hot topic. It should be Torah, substantively there part of it. And of course, the story that you were sharing about how, you know, there's always a little bit of gaiva. It's just a matter of do you acknowledge it or not. So he shared with all of us the ideas of, you know, who better to be the town rabbi? Who better to be the butcher than the one who's scared of it, than the one who's scared of it? Because it's either going to be you who's fearing this, or it's going to be someone who doesn't fear it. And that's even worse. Right. So I was just reminded a lot of our shared teacher in that. And I can see that it's certainly rubbed off on you, and hopefully on me as well.
Well, I'm sure it has. And because you bring up our dear Rabbi J.J. Schachter, in the process of getting haskamos, of getting different great figures to sign off on the book as worth reading, of course, Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter was one of the main addresses that I went to. And what I was so impressed by, I mean, I'm grateful to all the different rabbanim who wrote haskamos. Thank God there was a number of very chashuv rabbanim. You can look in the book over there. But Rabbi J. Schachter, unlike what's normal practice is, you know, rabbis are busy. I'm like a low tier rabbi. I can only imagine al achas kama kama. Certainly for people of his stature, they definitely don't have much free time. Yet I was so impressed. I asked Rabbi Schachter for a haskama. And he didn't simply just, you know, glaze over the manuscript and then write some perfunctory thing back to me. He emails me back and says, Moshe, when do you have an hour blocked off of time? I want to go through your manuscript with you. And he had notes on literally from the introduction to the final chapter. And he had ha'aros, and he even went through like the footnotes, and he found every little detail, whether it be substantive, whether it be grammatical, the content. And he even sent me additional sources to add as well, which I hope I got into the final print. So I was just so impressed with our Rebbe that he really makes so much time for all of us. And what I really learned from our chaburas with our Rebbe is that was the point he always drove home. If we were going to talk about whatever the hot topic was, it could be LGBT issues, it could be women in the, you know, like all the classic modern orthodox hot topics. So he always came in with like a minimum 50-page packet slapped down on the table, and everything was rooted in sources. And he said, any opinion is welcome at the table, so long as it's rooted in the serious reading of the source material. Not just a bike svara on the fly, not just a visceral reaction that I'm not able to handle a certain issue because emotionally I can't handle it. But based on a dispassionate reading of the sources, while also acknowledging the humans who are affected by it. They could go hand in hand with each other. So I really appreciate that. I was going to save that for the end, but you brought up our Rebbe and I had to mention that now.
No, absolutely. I'm remembering I would send him even drafts of articles I was writing, and he'd have like a whole 45-minute conversation with me on what can be added, what can be taken away, all the substance there. But I know if he was in the Zoom with us, he would say, "No, enough talking about me. Let's get into the substance."
Nah.
No, definitely, with that in mind,
that's only mix us, Shabbat. So.
But and Rebbe, I hope you are watching this. But let's talk about the substance a little bit. So there are three particular chapters that I wanted to bring up that are really relevant for a lot of those that I know in my local community and beyond. The first one probably being one of the more, let's say, fun ones for many people, Judaism and pop culture. Where do you see that relationship being? How do you see those two as getting along or not? And, you know, what would you suggest for those who are trying to balance in their lives? Completely hypothetical, of course.
Yeah. So it happens to be, I literally came by another Torah u-geekdom, another Torah synthesis between Torah and geek culture idea last night. My wife, Marissa, has been getting into Doctor Who recently. I'm very proud of her because she's actually not by nature a sci-fi fantasy person. So I was so excited when she swapped from her usual rom-coms to Doctor Who, and I saw it on the TV, and I was like, "Oh, you're watching Doctor Who!" You know, it's more British, but that's okay. So there was this episode that she was watching, and I looked up the script afterwards because you have to actually watch the scene to appreciate how it's delivered. But they're talking about, they go back in time, of course, and they meet Queen Victoria, and they're having dinner with her. And she wants to hear like an interesting ghost story. And he asks her, the doctor asks her, you know, why do you love hearing these kind of stories? So she says, "That's the charm of a ghost story, isn't it? The scares and the chills, that's just for children. But the hope of some contact with the great beyond, we all want some message from that place. It's the creator's greatest mystery that we're allowed no such consolation. The dead stay silent, and we must wait." And like, I was watching this, and like all of a sudden, all my pastoral training and Avelis and all these things were coming to my mind. And, you know, I'm not going to give you over the whole entire chapter right now. It's there for anyone who wants to see it. But there's so much that we could glean, whether it be from Lord of the Rings, whether it be from X-Men, and all these. I talked about, you know, the halachos of ordering a solar beam attack on Shabbos and Pokemon, and the implications of Bishul of Shabbos and Bishul from the Chama, from the sun, how that works. There's a lot you could take from it. But ultimately, from a philosophical standpoint, my conclusion was I don't see that there needs to be a synthesis between my hobbies of geek culture, whether it be Doctor Who, whether it be Dungeons and Dragons. I don't think it needs to go hand in hand with my religion. Now, of course, everything we do should be guided by God. But we're, I think, built within that, we're supposed to have some time for recreation, some time for downtime. Now, if I go and I play tennis for recreation, if I think like, "Oh, I see that there's a lesson in teamwork from here, and it makes a good Shabbos morning drasha," so, okay, beautiful. But there's no chiyuv, I think, that you have to try to glean like some kind of moral lesson every time you hit the tennis ball back and forth. The moral lesson is it's good to get exercise. It's good to get some downtime. So get back to doing what's most important. So I don't think there needs to be a synthesis between them. But to the degree that I notice things as I watch during my downtime, I think that's beneficial.
Yeah, that's a really
interesting. It's about being honest with oneself, really.
Of course. That's a really interesting framework. I guess I'm reminded of the chiluk that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein draws, I believe it was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, between having instrumental value versus inherent value. Sorry, it was Rabbi Norman Lamb. In Torah Umada, he draws that distinction. That something can have instrumental value, can be useful, even if it doesn't have inherent value in and of itself. Likewise, some things can have inherent value. It's just a matter of to what degree it's in conversation really with the Torah, where it's coming from the Torah, and how it's putting in conversation there. One thing Rav Lichtenstein did write, that I always connected to, was just the idea that there are some things in literature, you know, he was big on literature, less big on Doctor Who, but in literature, he said there are certain explanations of things, there are certain language used that he thought he would be in a worse state without having read within those writers' context and those novels. And, you know, it's something to keep in mind for sure.
Of course. And b'mechilas kvodo, you know, who am I to argue with Rev Lichtenstein, except that all the critics don't do, but that's not for me to do. But I guess using the halachic terminology that you're, I believe you're referencing, which is mitzvah versus hechsher mitzvah, inherent value versus instrumental value. Right. So I would think at best, in playing Dungeons and Dragons, maybe somehow, some way can lead to some kind of hechsher mitzvah. But here's my nafkamina, right? Here's the practical difference. If I have an hour blocked off of free time, and I have had my coffee, I'm all juiced up, I'm all ready to go, and I can really sink my teeth into something. So I can either learn a daf of Gemara right now, I can learn a Reb Chaim, I can learn a Rav Elchanan, or I can read the Odyssey or something else like that. I would hope, Leisman de Pulig, there really shouldn't be much of an argument that I should be sinking my teeth into that blot of Gemara right now. But for me, it's once I'm incidentally involved in all these different things, if I can glean some importance from it. Also, I'll tell you why. There's a little bit of counterculturalness to it. Now, I know fantasy culture has become a little bit more popular these days, and certainly Marvel has helped with sci-fi, even though I have my own qualms with how cheaply produced, and it's very shallow, I believe. But anyway, I'll get in trouble for that. But
you're safe with me.
I mean, you know what? We'll spend too much time on the sci-fi. But
why did it happen post?
Okay, you know, I'm gonna get into a whole rant about Marvel. Forget it. Let's go to the next topic. It's too
true. Okay. Sounds good to me. I will share just one last thing. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the story as well from Soloveitchik. One of the students in Yeshiva asked him, how can you justify learning philosophy so much? And the way the story's told over is that he says, oh, it's very simple. When the Moses Gedolei HaTorah are attacking me, I learn philosophy. When they're learning Torah, I'm learning Torah. So it's all about how we're using
it. I hear that. So, I mean, the counterculturalism I was going to talk, I'll just say briefly, is that I've gone to one too many sermons where there's like a modern Orthodox rabbi who's like kind of really yeshivish, but he wants to be relatable. So he always like, you know, starts off with a sports mashal. This is like my sishahaya. I went to a shul. I'm not going to give the place or any more details. I don't want it to be lashon hara. But the rabbi would start off literally every week. His Shabbos morning drasha would be some reference, some baseball or basketball game of Chvesnish. And first of all, I found it just super patronizing that you can't give a Dvar Torah without having to make some sort of pop culture reference. Now, if there's a really good reference, I'm all for it. But it, like, there shouldn't have to be a chiyuv. You know, I think it's like demeaning to your audience. And it's demeaning to Torah also to say that the Torah is not inherently compelling enough that I need to append some kind of pop culture mashal to it. That was number one. Number two, of course, not being a sports fan, it was completely lost on me, and then I was just upset for the rest of the drasha. So so I feel a little countercultural when I drop the Star Wars Lord of the Rings references for the one or two people in my audience who smile, and I see that for them it's worth it. Okay,
that actually raises a really good point, which is, you know, are you bringing this in just because it's really there and really belongs, or are you misrepresenting it in a certain way? Which really, I guess, brings us to the next part that I want to discuss after your book. You know, I am an outreach rabbi. I work in the, we can call it the Kiruv industry, quote unquote. So it's not really one singular industry, more different groups doing their own things. And something that I've seen many people worry about is, you know, you go to a Kiruv event and people are very worried. Am I being given a correct picture of Judaism? Or am I being given something sugar-coated, something that's not really true? And then I start wearing my kippah, I start going to from communities more, and I see that I was sold the wrong kind of product. I know we have an entire chapter in the book there. Obviously, I'm not asking you to share the entire thing, but I'll wriggle achas on one foot. You know, what do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'll wriggle achas. I think MS is a supreme value. Truth is a supreme value in Judaism. We don't need to go too far in the literature on that. Okay, I get into the technicalities, of our Shagar Tirchag, is that just judicial or not? But it's very clear that MS is a supreme value in Judaism. And so when we represent the Torah and we want to bring people closer to the Torah, we have to make sure we're actually bringing them closer to the Torah, not a misrepresented version of the Torah. Because if I have to start censoring mitzvos out of the Torah, and I need to start hiding things from someone. I'm not talking about, you know, according, if you're teaching a Kiruv curriculum, you can decide, okay, well, I'll start with Shabbos and Kashrus, and later on I'll talk about how Judaism is a patriarchal religion. I'll get to that later on. But, that's legitimate to decide when you introduce certain ideas. But if one's going to censor or give apologetics entirely, and by that you bring someone closer to, what are you bringing them closer to, actually? Is it to the Torah or something else entirely? So we have to make sure that we're not doing a ziyuf haTorah, that we're not actually creating a forgery, a misrepresentation of the Torah, God forbid, because then we're not doing a favor to God, and we're certainly not doing a favor to the person who thinks that they have bought into Torah. And I've seen this in the past. I mean, just during my brief stint, I don't want to say specific organizations, but I volunteer for a Kiev organization in college. You can probably figure out what it is. But I'm not going to say names out of principle. So I remember there was one young woman who reached out years later and said, you know, I didn't realize all these things about Judaism and gender and women, et cetera, et cetera. And now I feel a little conflicted that I bought into Orthodoxy. Now, again, my belief is that Orthodoxy is right. And that the best thing for a Jew to do is to be an Orthodox Jew. That is my belief unequivocally. But I want them to become an Orthodox Jew full well knowing what they are committing to. Because I think that is a more, and I think qualitatively that's more lasting. You know, we could talk about, I don't have statistics, unfortunately, but if I had to make a choice between quantitatively getting more people to sign on to Orthodox Judaism or qualitatively having less, but their commitments and their understanding of why they're doing and what they're signing on to is stronger, I would choose the latter. I don't think I get a bonus in my paycheck for every person who signs on to Orthodox Judaism, but I think that qualitatively beats quantitatively, and it also maintains the integrity of the Torah itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I got.
Absolutely agreed 100%.
I gained in the chapter for all the sources on how I back that up. There's an important Yamshel Shlomo over there. But okay,
yeah, we'll leave it's really worthwhile looking at that chapter because you do, you know, you're not afraid to challenge the assumptions really on both sides of that question. And obviously, I agree. You know, as someone who not only works in Kiruv, but is myself a product of Kiruv in many different stages of my life, you know, there was a time when I was very turned off from Orthodox Judaism because I felt like I was given a misrepresentation. I felt like I wasn't given what it really was. And I had to kind of rebuild it for myself. And I think having integrity and having accountability in outreach is so, so, so important. And Baruch Hashem, I think I'm part of an organization that does that very, very well. But I've certainly seen tragedies happen when yeah. It's not. So Kol HaKavod to you, Moshe, for really bringing this up.
And I'll give you a shout out. Make sure to listen to Steve's life story interview on 1840 podcast, where he elaborates on that.
Well, this is an interview for you, not for me.
Okay, but you deserve a shout out as well. So
yeah, and something that's really part of the discussion on Kiruv is really, you know, being careful in our speech and our presentations. We need to be sensitive. At the same time, we need to be able to speak proudly and freely. I know you have a chapter in the book that's also talking about that. How are we supposed to manage our speech? How does that deal with political correctness, things like that? So obviously, again, we're not going to go through the whole chapter, but you know, how does that come to bear on the conversations we've been having throughout and on how people can look at their lives and their own speech? Full disclosure, in Ottawa, we will be starting soon our Clean Speech Project. And it's really a big part of what we try to cultivate in the community. So I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. So that chapter you're referring to, which I think it's the first one in the book, is on Onas Devarim, which is basically the prohibition to oppress someone with words, to cause them distress emotionally. And I think I love the segue you're doing because this chapter was motivated, right? I have to be honest with my own motivations, by a similar thing I noticed, not necessarily within Kiruv Orthodox circles, but more broadly in the world or more liberal Orthodox circles, which is many times you'll see on more, especially on more sensitive issues, someone will cite a source that is not in line with what most liberal Western folks believe. And just by virtue of citing the source, even in a very neutral kind of tone, it could elicit a visceral reaction. Now, of course, I mean, we'll just address the elephant in the room. If I cite a source talking something about homosexuality in the Torah, which probably is not going to complement that way of life, then someone who is gay will naturally feel threatened by that. That's understandable. That makes sense. But the challenge that I've noticed, and it's not just in Jewish society, this is in America in general, is that our discourse has broken down, that we're not able to have conversations because all it takes is for party B to say, I'm offended by party A's idea, the expression that they're making, and then it shuts down the entire conversation. You could basically censor anything you want in the Torah simply by saying, I'm offended by it. I'll give you, and I'll tell you, sorry if I editorialize just a little bit. What troubles me also.
You're cognizant of the editorialization. That's good.
Yeah, there you go. What troubles me also, I mean, Steve, you and I went through this experience some time back. Just because Steve's here doesn't mean he agrees with me on this. I don't want to throw you under the bus. But I remember you, Yair, and myself, we had that those conversations among friends, and then people started complaining that it's a mantle and there are no women on it. And what troubled me also is just the idea that you're going to shut something down, you're going to pressure something to conform to what you want in your way, when there's no halacha about that. There's no halacha against having three men having a public conversation with each other. In fact, probably in the Haredi world, they would argue that is the way it's supposed to be. I'm not Haredi, so I'm not going to say I have no issue with women talking with men about Torah. I'm totally fine with that. We have that at our shul all the time. But the fact that that's what gets the visceral reaction from certain groups, and not when actual halachos are being broken publicly, something is backwards over here. It makes us ask the question, where are our values coming from? And when we introduce values that don't seem to necessarily emerge from the Torah, that are inconsistent, in order to shut down Torah conversations, I think that is a weaponization of the idea of Onas Devarim. And I don't even know if folks are going to use Onas Devarim and use the halachic terminology, but they're using the spirit of it to censor other parts of the Torah. And I think that, again, is going to be a disservice both to God, because his Torah can't be discussed, and to the general public, who won't be able to hear certain conversations because they don't conform to arbitrary norms that are popular these days.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I am remembering when we had that the drama, Yumi and our mutual friend, Rabbi Yair Lichtman, who's currently in Chicago, we had different conversations. And I do remember that really coming up and being, a lot of drama. I was on the side of, we should have representation. You were obviously on the side of we should be proud and strong and loud.
I wasn't against having representation, but I wasn't pro affirmative action and DAFKA putting someone on there simply because of their gender or something else. That was my
correct. But actually, my recounting of that actually does show how important it is to be precise in our speech. That we shouldn't obviously everyone editorializes to a degree, but we should be aware of that, and we should understand that when we're speaking to each other, we do so in such a way that is giving a full picture, that is taking the other side into account. Steel manning is a word that we use in debates often. We're putting up the best possible face to be up against. We're not putting up a straw man that's easily knocked down. And when we have speech in general with each other, it should be in a way that is productive rather than destructive.
Right.
And, that's something that I know that you've brought up as well. So we talked about a few different chapters in the book now. Obviously, we won't talk about all that much more. We do want people to read the book for themselves. It's a very wonderful book. Full disclosure, anyone in Ottawa who's interested, maybe we could get a few copies up here and we can do a little book club on it. So just putting that out there for people who are watching this video. But Moshe, I'm wondering if you have any last things you would want to say, any highlights that came up in writing the book, any particular things that you want people to really take away with them as they close the book and put back on their shelves, hopefully to take out again and to carry with them through their lives.
Right. So thank you. So again, thank you so much for your time. And I see we're running low on our 40-minute session here on our both unpaid Zoom accounts. So I'm glad we're into the wrap up. Number one, just an addendum to what I said before. I really don't want to come off, I'm sure some already think of me this way, and it's too late anyway, as just one of these folks who spends all their days railing against liberals and liberal Judaism, whatnot. I have the same criticism for those who worship Trump and those who, say that their religion basically winds up being determined by the GOP. It's all the same. My issue I take is that I think our goal, even I'm just a regular Joe, right? I try to keep the mitzvos the way I can. Do I slip up and do averas here and there? Yeah, of course, just like any other person. But I think in principle, something that every single person, or at least every Orthodox Jew, needs to agree on is that our raison d'etre is to serve the will of God. And any question that comes our way, whether it be something perhaps as technical as having a seam during the 9 days, whether it be something as important as perhaps being duplicitous in how we represent the Torah, whether it be talking about political correctness, it always has to start with the guiding question, What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want? What does Hashem want? And the only way we can determine that, to the best of our ability, the closest we're going to get, is by looking at what our rabbinic scholars, what Chazal, and what all subsequent generations, how they were able to interpret the Torah, such as rabbinic Judaism. That's how it works. And so in my book, it's not meant to be an encyclopedia on every single sugya. I make sure to quote the secondary sources that I found primary sources, and that's how research works. Maybe people won't say it, but that is how it works. So for instance, if I'm just pulling off my shelf here. I did not plant that. But take the Sefer right here, Big Day-ish. This is an entire specialty Sefer written literally on the topic of Lo Yilvashi, Isser of cross-dressing, and all the related sugyos. This was a very helpful book in doing my literature. And I encourage anyone who wants to learn more about Lo Yilvash, pick up a book like this, order a book like this, and you'll find all the sources that you need. But what I'm trying to do is begin that conversation and make sure that conversation is rooted in the source literature. And from there, if you want to disagree with my analysis, kol hakavod, that is the milchamta shel Torah. That is what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to have the machlokas, but what makes it l'shem shemayim is that we're trying to figure out what is the will of shemayim, what is the will of Hashem. If that is no longer our goal, that's when things begin to break down. But if we could all agree on that initial premise, even if we might have different interpretations, different analyses, different arguments, it ultimately puts us on the same team. We're under the same tent, and we're all trying to figure out the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's, going back to Rabbi J. Schachter, to our discussion, precisely what he taught us in the Chabura, and he drilled home, is that here's a 50-plus page source packet on the issue that you guys asked me yesterday to put together, and now I want to have a discussion rooted in those sources. That's what I attempted to do with the Sefer, and I pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it will accomplish that goal. So thank you very much, Steve. It's so wonderful to connect with you and your community members, anyone else who's listening. And until next time, hope to learn together again.
Amen. Thank you so much for coming on, Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Kurtz. It's been really a pleasure. And your book, Challenging Assumptions, is available for, I believe, pre-order from Mosaica Press. Anyone who's interested can go onto their website. I'll put a link in the description. I'll put a link in the comments, depending on where you're watching this. And we should all have the merit of having our assumptions challenged as we lead into the new year.
Amen. Love that. Okay, right. Take care.
You too.